This is Dave Crippen, and it's August 2nd, 1985. We are talking today to Mr. Robert F. Andrews, who lives in Royal Oak and has had a long and interesting career as a designer in mainly with the automobile industry at Hudson and at Studebaker and beyond. Today, Mr. Andrews is an independent freelance designer, still very, very keeping his hand in the industry. And today we are asking him to tell us the highlights of his design career, beginning with his first influences.
Well, thank you, Dave. And I think to begin with, I was brought up not too far from Detroit, Monroe, Michigan, and through the junior years in school, I had my fellow automobile lovers, several friends, that early, in grade school on through from the 32 on, we would do like so many young men all over the country, spending half of our time at the dealerships, watching them prepare the new cars and keeping track of where each dealership hid their new automobiles when they came in the last of August. And so we were always doing our homework on where these cars would be stored, so we would be the first ones to see them, you know, before the introduction. And of course, as you recall, the introduction of new model was a very, very big event, because it didn't have, it was an emotional, enthusiastic event that when a dealership had new cars then at that time, I mean, everyone in town would get down there. And so, I mean, that was basically my interest started very, very young. And then I drew an awful lot of automotive and aircraft, which I was interested in both at the same time. And that went through the school years, out of high school, and the war started. Not being in too good of physical shape at that time with a back problem, I did not go into the service, and so I joined the engineering firm of Monroe Auto Equipment. And through the war years, I got acquainted more with the formalities of development. The engineering department, we had a very small, very good department, and we did a lot of work on tanks and aircraft components. And
excuse me, who were the guiding geniuses behind the Monroe Auto Parts?
The McIntyre boys, the three of them, they're gone now. And Brower McIntyre was the creative head and chairman for years. And we would get, we were working through Aberdeen Proving Grounds, and also through Chrysler tank arsenal. So our early battles brought some weak points up, and we would get that report and work day and night to revise. And I think probably one of our best efforts was they were having great difficulty with driving the tanks under wartime conditions and speeds that they had to go. And the leverage was extensive when those multi-ton things would hit any kind of a rise, and they were injuring drivers and breaking some necks along that way. So we developed a hydraulically suspended, the first hydraulic suspended seat for the driver, and gunner, I believe, for that. And then we tore down some German aircraft that we got a hold of for the hydraulics to improve our seals and centerless grinding capabilities and to bring us up to date, because the Germans were quite a bit ahead of us at that time. So that period of time was the foundation. At the same time, I was using my art, developing that, and Glenn White, a sales engineer with Monroe, had come from Hudson Motor Car Company. We'd started the same day, and as time went on, we became great friends, and he introduced me to Frank Spring. And it was the last, it was 1944, the last 44, early 45, I got a release so that I could go and work on the new Hudson. Now, I was scared, like any other young designer, because I'd gone right from that schooling, direct schooling, of Monroe, and I found we had a very, very small staff. Art Kibiger was our chief designer. We had a very small modeling unit, and I will try to keep this simple. We only had three modelers. Mm-hmm. And here we did a whole line of cars. Art Kibiger, myself, and Bill Kirby. Frank Spring was director, but not actively as a designer. He was our representative for the corporation. And
did you remove to Detroit at this
Oh
point?
Yes, I moved to Rose Point. Mm-hmm. And I lived in a place called Shangri-La. It was different automotive personnel would be allowed in some of the big homes. Mm-hmm. We would rent a room there. The people were very good about that. And that turned out to be quite a boon, because I was right into the total enthusiasm of some of the executives that later, like Gordon McKenzie and some of the other boys. We followed each other through our careers, you know. And
where was the design unit at Hudson located?
Right on Connors. Above the old engineering building, which is torn down now. Mm-hmm. And probably one of the most interesting things that happened is that I was better prepared than I thought I was. Mm-hmm. And I was scared like any other young person who went into the area, and learned quite quickly there about the status of the design department, and that we were not too popular with the engineers. However, like in any discipline like that, we found we did develop some good allies, and Charlie Cherriez was one of them, and Cherie. I believe there was a Z in there, Z-E. I think I have it in the Hudson book there. And that program, we always, all the way through that program, and I got into, they had done some work on the structures during the war with a very slim group, with Art Kibiger and Frank Spring doing design work during the war, because they were building the aircraft wings, you know, for the SBC and dive bomber and center section of the B-26. And in our design department, they had done some work for the B-29 also. So we had these drawings. By edict, we had to have these aircraft drawings always available to put on our table in case people came in, but it turned out that the government had given all the auto companies around 1943, 44, the go-ahead to prepare, do some preparation that they had to do for the peace that was to come, to get so that they could get going right away. So
post-war
the
post-war,
yeah, had to be very, very quick.
Right.
So we were very concerned at that time with General Motors, Ford, and Packard, thinking they all had a much more newer car, and that we didn't know really where we were until that car came out and found out how far ahead we really were. You know, that was a great surprise. The secrecy at that time between corporations was a paramount thing. Rumors would get out, but usually they would come through the DAC and maybe a vendor, but I think vendors were much more disciplined then than they later became. Yes, yes. So we could find very little was going on with the other companies, and I think this was good. I'd like to see more of it today. And so that was developed, and we developed that whole line, the 8 and the 6, the Commodore series and the Super 6 series, without one night of overtime.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only three of us involved in that whole mm-hmm. program.
Who were they?
And that was Bill Kirby, Frank Spring, Art Kibbinger was our studio head.
Mm-hmm.
And then Don Butler was there for a while, and he has written a book, which I haven't seen yet, on mm-hmm. Hudson.
Oh, has he?
Yeah, he was a stylist there, Don Butler. And the decision-making aspect was more involved with Kibbinger and myself and Bill Kirby. We actually did finalizing the situation. Of course, we didn't have a test track. All the other companies had a test facility, so the Hudson was developed. We only had one prototype for a while there,
mm-hmm.
and so the car was driven up north and back every night for a while. You know, I mean, it's with the change of crews and. So during that period, a neighbor, he was the head of the Fuel Charger Corporation. I can't recall his name. I will get that for you.
Mm-hmm.
And he was later became the chief engineer for the all new car, the Tucker Torpedo at that time, the Tucker. While working on the Hudson, I also got involved a little bit on the Tucker thing. I wanted to qualify for that, so I did a few things, especially in the latter part of the Hudson. No, I did. I met Alex Tremulous down in Chicago,
uh-huh.
and I was going to work for them, but that was when I. Went down there. That was just the day after they closed the place up. So here Alex was sitting there alone, and a dead corporation around him, and all these cars unfinished on the line. I remember seeing that. But I knew Preston Tucker was really. he was totally misrepresented during that period because of that political situation.
Right.
They tried to discount him and his efforts. That car was a very fine automobile, and it would have been a good thing. It would have been, yes. But I did a qualifying design after leaving Hudson. I went with Willys Overland. In fact, the Hudson group moved down to work on the Jeepster, which had been really started by Brooks Stevens. Had done the original concept What is not commonly known is Art Kivager and myself, but we did the production version of the Jeepster and the wagon, the Westchester wagon, and then worked up some the 102-inch passenger car, several directions for that, did not happen, really, you know. Mm-hmm. The Aero Willys was done by Phil Wright back in Detroit. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that period of time, Willys Overland was very, very interesting, and I still have some cars I'll show you sometime that were worked up for that program.
Can we, before we leave Hudson, can you elaborate in some detail on exactly what models you worked on and how the design function worked, the small, almost independent group that you had?
Yes, we as I mentioned before, we had a very, very minimal equipment. In other words, we only had one full-size model, and they were done in plaster, and $2 for front-end studies.
Right.
And our chief engineer was Tonkrey, a gentleman by the name of Tonkrey, and I can't remember his first name, it's in that book there. So we worked hand in hand with him, and Art Kivager had done some preliminaries during that war period, during the 42, 43, 44, and then when I joined them, then we were just getting ready to nail down the profile and the final editing of the Hudson. Now, the models were involved. We had a club coupe, a two-door, a four-door, and a Commodore. We had the Commodore 6, the Highline, and the Commodore 8, which was the straight 8, and a convertible. So all of the interiors, and the interesting, I think the part that was interesting, especially now, and something that we took for granted at that time, was companies later had specific divisions for the interior and exterior and all that, and color and all, and we did everything.
In one studio.
In one small studio. Mm-hmm. And our studio was, that is for our drawing boards, where was only 15 feet long and about 8 or 9 feet wide. And that's how tiny area that we had. Mm-hmm. And then Kivager had one room, and Frank Spring had his own room. And it was fascinating because we had the die models, all the plaster work and the die models of the fine mahogany, and also our interior, our seating engineer and fabrics and all that. It was all on the third floor of the old engineering building. Kelly, stop. And so we had this wonderful aroma of fine woods, the real materials, the wools, plaster. It smelled like an aircraft factory inside. So if we could bottle this stuff nowadays, it would really be great. Our day was a concentrated day of under the directorship, you know, Frank Spring and Kivager, that we worked on development bumper systems, different front end masses, and then if they were edited, we went through that very interesting editing, and then of course during this time, the 47, 46 and 47 facelifts of the original Hudson was done too, so we were very, very busy.
The
current and the current stuff. Right. And I found it most interesting. And we talked about automobiles all day, like a group of designers would. Frank Spring, in his office on the second floor, had a very large, very plain wooden box. Must have been about 5 feet. 4 by 5 feet and about 3 feet high, and it was just crammed full of foreign pre-war brochures. And our interest, that is certainly for Kirby and myself and Art Kivager, we talked constantly about the Formula One racing in Europe before the war. We had all this information. And our influence for the Hudson, I mean, it actually was a, structure-wise, was of the pre-war Tatra, 1937, Czechoslovakian Tatra, which had a similar structure.
G-E-T-R-A.
Yes. And so we were, our motivation, our starting points were really European as much as possible interest, you know, that's what we were, where we were coming from. And aerodynamics was our keynote. The power to weight ratio, although we wanted to build the car for at 3,000 pounds to keep the power to weight ratio is at least as good as the pre-war Hudson, which was one of the best in the industry. It was around 27, 28 pounds per horsepower, and we went over that. That the Hudson, because of the overbuilding of the structures, it was actually over-engineered, really, it turned out. It was about 600 pounds over what we intended on. But other than that, the car was turned out to be the best handling and the most comfortable of the post-war cars, certainly in its class. And I find looking back on it now much more exciting than, even though it was exciting at the time, you had the day-to-day almost fear-based, you know, by your competition. And also I found out very early in the design in what Detroit calls styling, we did not call our stuff styling. That's for hairstylists. This was we had the European term for our office, the design office. And we had a racing, Reed Railton was our consultant designer. We did have a short period with him, you know, from England. R-A-I-L-T-O-N, Railton.
Is he well known in the field?
Oh, yes. He had designed some of the super racing cars in Europe. Cobb. He designed Cobb's, John Cobb's 300-mile-an-hour car. And I wish we had I wish he had spent more time there, because he was definitely an ally. And the company would listen to him very much, especially on our aerodynamics, our theory. To carry that out, the Hudson probably would have done very well in the wind tunnel tests of later time, and it would pass any structure of the contemporary cars is the drop test or the rollover. The integrity of the Hudson is known to this day, you know, relative to the strength and everything for a crash and all that.
Does this reflect what you mentioned elsewhere, that you had very good relations with the structural and body engineers?
Yes, we did. Yes, we definitely did. And mind you, that the people that were department heads at that time, in the mid-40s, was the same personnel that had been there in the 20s. Mm. See, so we had this wonderful history to pull from, and the continuity of personnel that you don't have anymore. You don't know anyone you work with anymore. It's so it was personalized in that respect, and you had fewer people involved in the decision making at that time. And that turned out to be a luxury that certainly went by the wayside from the 50s on, say the mid-50s, that was all gone in all the countries.
So decision making was a pleasant chore, pretty much. You could come to a decision fairly quickly.
Yes, yes. And I'm trying to recall the topics. Well, the president of the company,
Mr. Barrett,
A.E. Barrett, was a fine gentleman, and he would just make his appearance every few weeks. It wasn't every week at all, and show you how apparently the confidence he had in the group, because he was not involved personally in all these decisions. He did not ran a nice, well-organized ship, and Tonkrey was our day-to-day management contact.
You mentioned Mr. Schutte, or Schutte.
Oh, yes, Eric Schutte.
Yes.
You know, he was our body engineer, and a very charming man, and had been in Hudson for some time, and was a delight to work with, because he didn't have any prejudice against the what they call more or less the art and color personnel. The designer at that period, we lived and worked in isolation. That was in other words, you rarely got over into the different areas, and only a few people could get into your section. So this isolation, although very good for some areas of our endeavor, I believe was not too good in one way, because we didn't get to an overall feeling of the company as much.
Were you invited to marketing strategy meetings, product planning meetings?
No. That's why I mentioned that.
Yes, right.
So there was an awful lot of guesswork of what they're thinking.
Right.
Even though we had a direct engineering contact, but on the sales aspect, and in fact, we were concerned why we were not, that isolation from the regular management. Like we didn't see the sales manager, I think his name was Davis, twice in 3 years.
Oh, really? That was isolated.
And, but Frank Spring got to see him.
Ah.
So everything kind of was secondhand at in that area, and not, in other words, we are to design the car, but there just certainly was not that communication as far as the sales area and our dealerships, types of dealerships, and their marketing approach. We just simply were out of, we had very little input there.
Of course, as you mentioned, you were coming up with a fairly unconventional car.
Yes.
And,
yes.
It would have been at least instructive for you to know exactly what market people thought that whether they could sell it or not.
That's true, and there was a part of this underlying fear we had is, my gosh, this is great and all that.
But is it too far out?
But is it too far out or too far in or mm-hmm. what's Ford and what GM? So we felt that our influence was not appreciated at times like any group of designers. And to prove that, Bill Kirby and I concocted a little plan that I remember drawing up this fictitious Buick. Mm-hmm. And
now, was this did you say Bill Kirby knew concocted it? Was it a deliberate
well we
attempt?
Were oh yeah it was a deliberate attempt
yeah.
And in other words, we thought if any sketch came in from the outside, they would snap it up and pay much more attention to a normal idea that we might bring up on the local front. Well, I remember I put it on it and didn't. And Frank Spring came in, he picked it up and he said, "What is this?" And I said, "Well, a friend of mine over at GM working on the new Buick, and this is so far a local joke." Well, it turned out to be much more than that. He took it over and they had a board meeting on it and they called me over. I was scared to death to verify this came from General Motors. And so it was an inside joke between Bill Kirby and I for the rest of the program. And
What innovations were you able to bring to the immediate post-war models, the facelifts that distinguished it from other immediate post-war models? Also facelifts.
Yes, well, the Art Kevitzer did that, the front end, which was very, very new, that where you're using the full depth of a scoop. Remember how the grill came in and you just saw a black area?
Yes.
A full depth expression.
Yes.
Well, that was the first car to although the rest of the Hudson was very pre-war and old-fashioned, not terribly attractive, as you recall. But that front end established a very new angle, which the 49 Ford later, you know, came where you're using the full depth of black and not covering the front entirely with grill. You suggested this intake. I think a Hudson at that time, we were doing more with plastics than anyone on the interiors, to developing plastic decor that would stand up. Hudson.
Still really a relatively infant.
Very, very much so, yes. And then also, Hudson probably did more than any other company at that time, color wise, with metallics. We were the first ones to have to go into. Finishes. They had started their exotic finishes about 1938.
Really?
And so I forgot particular the paint company, but they did. I heard a vendor say later that they did more sample colors for Hudson than they did for all of General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Spring was very creative that way as far as bringing new materials in to the picture. The quality of manufacturing was very high. I didn't realize until I went with Hudson how independent that company really was. It was the only company that made everything except their spark plugs. They made their engine, their body, their seats, and they had electric or auto light. They used auto light accessory on the inside, and also they were the first to have a very, very effective heater fresh air unit, full circulating inside, so you didn't have the fog, the
right.
Hudsons didn't fog up.
Yeah.
And then their transmission was excellent. We did not have the callbacks then, like they do now. There was another thing. Test time was not frantic. Ralph Whistler, Sr., was chief development engineer and had the test garage below us and whatnot. And there was something very, very quality and non-panic the way engineering worked at Hudson. They just simply quietly developed things and to a point where it was acceptable on a consistent manufacturing basis.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had a custom area of the factory where the convertibles were custom made. In other words, they did not have regular dies. They simply cut the top off from a club coupe body and reinforced on the inside, and all that sheet metal work changed in the A-pillar and then the deck and cowl. It was all done by hand. So that was, of course, shades of the 30s,
right,
when so much custom work was done. Our labor situation at that time was horrendous. In spite of all the quality we're talking about, which was true on the line, we had many wildcat strikes, sometimes two or three a week for 4 or 5 hours.
Effectively, you negate whatever the
shift. I think that period from 45 on through the 50 mark was a very bad period in the industry, because the union, even in engineering, our draftsmen are all unionized, and I don't want to sound so anti-union, because I'm not really, except for the type of leadership that they had during that period was all confrontation.
Yes.
It was a mean, adversarial thing, and looking back on it, I think that the top management of all the corporations did not use good public relations tools that they certainly had available to put that onto a more firm ground. Because
labor relations hadn't come into the 20th century yet.
It certainly hadn't. No, certainly hadn't. Mm-hmm. In fact, we would have fights. Occasionally, there was an attempt to unionize the designers. And Bill, I forget who the fiery. You know, they have stewards, union steward type came in, and there was a confrontation, and Bill Kirby and him, he was going to take a plaster hammer to Bill. These boys were tough, but actually that was a small part of our operation. We normally didn't have anything to do with them, and we could not do very much on the scale models. In other words, our hands were off. Everything had to be done by a modeler, because they were unionized.
The models were unionized.
Yes, there.
Wait
a minute, the engineering was unionized, and they were trying to unionize the modelers, and they couldn't do it, or the designers, that's true. But it was a pretty tight shop as far as the body draftsmen were concerned, and the interior mechanics and whatnot. I don't know about I don't believe the engineers on the chassis build-up and development, I don't think they were unionized either. But I think what I'd like to mention is that Art Kevinger and myself, we went down to just before the car was announced, we left the company and went down to Willie's Overland.
Forgive me.
Yes.
One last question, if I may. Can you describe the step down Hudson you wanted to be working on? Was that the pre-war? I mean, the immediate post-war, not the immediate, but the new post-war.
That was an all new car. Yes, that had the perimeter frame.
Right.
You know, around the rear wheels.
Can you describe that in some detail? That seemed to me to be a real innovative car.
Yes, well, the structure tended to be quite heavy, and we had our side rails went over to the top and were tied across with a fairly heavy member, both on the rear deck and in the top of the windshield. And a very strong structure on our instrument panel area that also was a structural. The instrument panel was a structural member also. Mm-hmm. And it was not just an attached thing. Mm-hmm. And then we had our double sill on the bottom of the chassis. We had a chassis outside of the normal chassis dimension on our width. We also had our full sill that went around the rear wheels and mm-hmm. tied that in.
Mm-hmm.
So the car definitely with the advantage of the almost monocoque construction mm-hmm. of this body, we had already built in a limitation for design change. Which again, you have to convert into marketing strategy. That we here suddenly we had basically a European development that should have had a 7-year span at least of refinement. Like when Mercedes brings out a body, they just refine and refine and run that quite a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we were set up for longevity on the Hudson, but we, in the true marketing, it was a very fickle year-to-year customer relationship because people were used to big change, and the Americans at that time wanted real visible change from year to year, not a subtle change.
Right.
So here Packard and Hudson both were tied in to a very expensive tooling of their post-war car
mm-hmm.
and very minimal change allowance because of their budget
mm-hmm.
Relative to Ford or General Motors.
Yeah.
They could not afford the big changes. So here they were committed to a minimal change, very quality car,
mm-hmm.
but to a fickle public. So that itself turned out to be a nemesis for Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
The very idea that was so fine and what made it so good was turned out to be a limitation. The Hudson dealers tended to have a pattern all over the country. A very conservative, older, some Packard-Hudson combination dealerships. But in most cases, the Hudson following were not young people. They did not have the young 25 to 35 year old executive or high achiever like was driving the Mercury and the Lincolns. The Lincoln Club Coupe or convertible, the Ford and Mercury, a convertible, Club Coupe. Now that was the younger set.
Yes.
Now this is actually what we were designing to more of the LaSalle group, as far as appreciation in the Hudson group, and of course at that time the Buick. We used a 42 Buick Fastback Super Series, for our Bible in developing the New Hudson. In other words, we use that to work from. In other words, when the car gets newer looking and better looking than the 42 Buick, then we knew we had that was our milestone car that we worked from on development of the Hudson. I wished I had that model. That model was broken up, like so many models that we have there. In fact, 1946, I believe it was, a crew came in, suddenly came in, and they took all these models off the wall. These were 3/8 models and quarter size models with full detail interiors, and they were all junked.
Did you ever find out who ordered that or why it was done?
No, space.
Some efficiency expert.
Efficiency expert, and we somehow we never did really know. Mr. Tonkrey usually was very quiet about these things. You never really knew. These things just happened. And
well, this is another engineering difficulties. Convince Mr. Ebinger that you and he should leave the company.
Kibinger, yes.
The Kibinger, I'm sorry.
Yes, Kibinger had been there since 1935. He was a fairly young man, about 35 at the time, 37, 38. And Hudson was funny that way. Although it was a family, in one sense, it was very cool in another. Kibinger, I recall, he was very disappointed. I had this offer to go to Willys Overland because there are very few qualified people by the end of the war in the automotive development.
Right.
Some had retired during the war and gone on to different things, and so suddenly there were a lot of car programs and very few designers.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a bit of moving around at that time. But no, Hudson didn't make any particular, even though we had finished this what was to be quite a dynamic car. They didn't make any great effort at all to keep us. Not at all. And it was a bit disappointing, but that's the truth. And
you, Mr. Ebinger, saw the car eventually as it came out. And
well, that fall, or the fall of 47,
right.
And when the 48 came out, we were invited to the press preview.
Uh-huh.
Now, this has got to be one of the most exciting things that ever happened to me. It happened later with other cars,
mm-hmm.
but it was the first experience of silently gliding through a show, a specific show of the all-new car that you spent quite a bit of time on, and some good and some bad, and like anxiously awaiting the approval of the critics at a Broadway play.
Right.
It had all that feeling, and suddenly we had all the press from the New York Times, the Detroit papers and whatnot, and to see and to hear, because they didn't know who we were. In fact, designers got very, outside of the chief designer, were generally unknown, and not, companies rarely mentioned them.
Right.
And we were fairly low profile that way. But anyway, to hear the and see the reaction of the critical press, which was great approval at that time, and it was a very exciting evening. So.
You did get an awfully
Very good press on that.
Yeah. But you mentioned elsewhere that you were both you and Mr. Ebinger were slightly disappointed with the aesthetics, the final.
Art Kibinger,
yes.
Yeah, now, as you get familiar, when you're working on something several years and you're developing, there always seems to be, in many cases, regrets. That only you would know about. It was all new and great to everyone else, but I think what we wanted was First of all, we wanted the car to be lighter than it was, so it'd be faster.
Yeah.
You know. Secondly, the detail work we wanted would be a bit more subtle.
It is.
The detail of the diecast. You know,
yes.
The letter Hudson was too big. You know, things like that would irritate us necessarily. We'd like to have gone a little bit more aerodynamic in the front end and pulled some air in a little more subtle manner. But overall, looking at the Hudsons years later at the big National Hudson Meet Show, have you ever been to one of those? They had one of the largest ones right in your backyard at the in Dearborn, the Hudson Show about 4 years ago. National, and they had 850 cars there from all over the country. But looking back at the 48, when you see all the Hudsons lined up and everything, it was actually quite clean.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered why we criticized it at the end of the program. I think we were thinking in terms of finer grills, openings, like the 39 Buick had.
Yes.
You know, remember the
it's
a matter of scale. Of some of the trim, and I think a little deeper section, or we had 11-inch height windows, and we wanted them deeper. We wanted to pull that belt line down a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
and to cut some visual weight out of the Hudson. But nobody objected to it the way it was,
mm-hmm.
As it turned out to be. But we would like to have had a little lighter look.
Now, were those decisions taken by the structural engineers or the body?
Some of that, yes. Some of the sections, like the heaviness of the roof section, we wanted thinner.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Tonkray, I forget his first name. Well,
don't give it here, no.
I don't
give
it. In Northrop, Jim Northrop, they were very concerned about making anything light on that car. I mean, it was a bit heavy-handed,
yeah.
and they had the authority.
Yeah.
See, at Hudson, at Ford and General Motors and whatnot, the chief designer, that is what they call a chief stylist in some areas.
Yeah.
Had cabinet rank, in other words, was a vice president.
Right.
Which, as it should be.
Although that didn't come for another decade, I think.
Well.
At least at Ford.
That's right. You're true. It's very true. So, Frank Spring was called the director
right.
of styling. And his job, and he was outnumbered by all these vice presidents, you see. So,
yeah.
He had his problems, too.
Mm-hmm.
And compromise is the name of engineering anyway.
Right.
And but all in all, it came out
certainly
it was pretty good.
Properly accepted.
And, but in the marketing, that is the sales efforts went along very well the first 2 years, and they were in trouble very, very shortly. And mostly because of the evolutionary approach did not fit the immediate marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how they could have told that ahead of time anyway, because one problem that we had, all companies had, on developing their post-war car was during the mid part of the war and toward the end, some of the basic materials companies, like the brass, aluminum, steel companies were putting fictitious post-war cars in their advertising, and these were usually done not by automobile designers, but commercial artists in Pittsburgh or someplace else, and they were showing these bars of soap with wheels, and that turned out to be quite a serious thing, because executives from all over believe what they would see in an ad.
Yes.
And it was quite a thing to fight off.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Mr. Frank Spring, of course, as you well know, the heart sort of went out of the design area when he was killed.
Yes. Yes. No, we were gone.
You were gone
that
by
time,
then, but it was shortly after you left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, actually, it was 54, 55.
Oh, that.
Because they had merged with American Motors. That's by that time.
Right.
And I think he was doing something on that little, remember the little Metropolitan?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
He was killed coming back from the West Coast on a hotted up car, which was a very unfortunate thing.
Well, in any event, you and Mr. Evinger
moved on. Kibiger.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Mr. Kibiger moved on to another field, and you began to describe that a few minutes ago. Could you tell how that happened and what
Well, Ward Kennedy was the chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And
Had Mr. Sorensen come on?
And we followed Mr. Sorensen
right.
down. Yes.
Charles Sorensen,
yes.
Had left Ford under a cloud. And
yes, and a very charming man.
And Ward Kennedy had asked him to come on.
Yes, and Kennedy, as you recall, would play with that company for years. He was one of the world's wealthiest men, and certainly one of the wealthiest men in the United States at that time. He was worth $86 million in 1946 or 7. So he could have easily financed the tooling program, which is only about $20 million back in those years, you know, for an all new car practically. In fact, it was much less than that figure. But we were called down to develop a new car.
Where were they located?
At Toledo, Ohio.
Toledo, right.
And we had this marvelous old Willys administration building that was torn down a few years ago.
Now, John Willys had died by this time.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But the Willys Jeep had just done fantastically in that development through the war years. And actually, that was originally a Ford product.
Mm-hmm.
They were asked to make the first prototype, as you recall.
Right.
And then the contract was let out to Willys Overland because Ford was so busy on so many
right.
other areas.
And then later Ford subcontracted on it. Right?
Absolutely, yes, that's true. And so we had a Hudson crowd down there. Eric Schutte came down, chief body engineer.
Oh, great.
And
you worked harmoniously with him.
Oh, yes, before. And Art Kibiger, myself. And Dio Wooten was added. He was a designer. He was added to the staff.
What was his name
again? Wooten, L-U-T-O-N. And then our job was also to develop a new post-war passenger car. And the confusion there was a product line confusion of what kind of a car to follow. And we were encouraging Willys Overland to stay in the specialized car
Good.
Field and not try to enter the Chevrolet field, which they did, Chevrolet Ford and the Aero car, and it did not go over. It was as expensive as a Ford, but smaller and less of it, and not
right.
terribly exciting. So I worked on several a new prototype, couple of cars, and also a new Jeepster to follow. That when I'm doing a story on that for Automobile Quarterly, I think they asked for it 10 years ago, and I'm just getting around to it now. But as you know, on history,
oh, yes.
It doesn't really
no.
it doesn't matter. The interest is out there.
Had they made the decision by the time you got there to concentrate on the admiration and enthusiasm
for the Jeep,
the built-in market for the Jeep?
Oh, definitely,
yeah.
Yes, definitely had. Yeah. In fact, my sales again, Willys Overland, like many companies of that time, auto companies had isolated divisions. within the corporation that it was up to your the designer's job is to create his own areas of information within the company.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was not encouraged. Ooh. Incidentally, it was not encouraged. Well, that is where I met Gordon McKenzie.
Oh, yes.
And he lived just a few doors down from me in Toledo.
Was he in sales then?
And he was a very junior in the sales department, mm-hmm. regional. And so we spent many hours at Dyer's in Toledo, a restaurant, that very old restaurant.
Yes.
So we would have our meetings, rather than within the company, we'd have them in the evening down there because I was getting sales input from him, and he was getting design input from me. And so we developed a very fine professional and personal relationship. And then he went on with Ford Motor, Mercury Division in the 50s and whatnot.
Apparently with Ford of Europe.
Yes, Ford of Europe. And I see him occasionally. I understand he's retired now.
Just about.
And
sort of an emeritus position.
Yes. And
so you're able at least to get some feeling of what the marketing sales department were thinking.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, it was hard to, Barney Roos, probably the most interesting thing down there.
Yes.
Well, Barney Roos was the chief engineer and was probably one of the best known chief engineers in the world at that time. Now, he had done the President's Straight Eight and the Studebaker series of engines mm-hmm. in the 20s, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he was extremely dynamic person. He was very dictatorial, and again, I'll never.